The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 12. Two Disasters Averted. A lesser man would have probably outed himself. A lesser man would have died. Severus, though, was not a lesser man. Severus, as Hermione Granger had once accurately described, had a permanent poker face, and so he didn't raise a brow nor move a muscle when they were greeted at the entrance by a line of dejected and morose teachers and a grinning Electo Caro at the head. "Severus, you're back," said Electo, showing her teeth. She looked a bit like a monkey. "You didn't say you'd bring us company."
"It was a last-minute decision," Severus answered. And if his voice was colder and harder than usual, who could tell? Severus was surprised, but so was Bella. She had been so sure that the moment they set foot in Hogwarts they would see all kinds of Muggleborns and students drawing signs reading "Die, Voldemort, die." To be fair, she wasn't that far from the truth, but here they were, with the teachers dutifully forming a line to show their respect for the headmaster. Minerva had her eyes cast down, looking at the floor. Even when the Caros were here, well, they were here now, but even at the beginning of the course is what Severus meant. When the Caros were seconds away from murdering her, Minerva had been glaring daggers at them. Minerva took Amicus's wand. Muchie looked down now, soft and old and defeated. And Severus seriously considered the possibility that he had done something wrong at the gates and they had come to a different universe. He did not have the energy to defeat Voldemort in two universes. He didn't. Bella wanted to see the whole castle and all of Severus's achievements. The others just wanted to see their children. Slughorn bowed and said he would bring the kids at once, and they moved to wait in the little room next to the great hall. Professor Sprout served them drinks with a calm and empty look that in no way gave the impression that she hoped they all choked on their drinks and died. Things were working for Severus, but he was not in control, and it was terrifying. This downcast Minerva was truly the most uncanny thing he had ever seen, and he routinely held Voldemort's gaze.
"And where's your brother?"
asked Bella, her eyes fixed on Electo, who was adjusting her breasts inside her bra, a vulgar gesture that seemed quite natural on her. She laughed, Electo did, with that piggish laugh that was so grating.
"Eager to see him, eh?"
she leered at Bellatrix. "He's just finishing with some students, don't you worry." Indeed, Amicus came soon after, greeted everyone, and told Severus, as if this had been a long-held conversation that they kept having and interrupting, that Madame Pomfrey was truly bothersome.
"The point of a punishment is to be felt," he said. "Healing them afterwards erases the correction in their rotten character."
"A dead student can hardly correct his ways," Severus replied hollowly.
"They're hardly going to die from some old-fashioned flogging."
It was probably the most surreal experience in Severus's life, and he had once seen Harry pick a flower, a real flower, out of the drawing in a book. Harry had looked at him with his big eyes wide open in surprise when the flower vanished soon after from his hand, as if he couldn't understand what he had done wrong when Severus couldn't even begin to say how he had done it at all. They asked him about the discipline, about what the students were learning. Michael Corner, Ravenclaw prefect, was brought to the room and dutifully recited the ministry-sanctioned pamphlet on blood purity. Laura Bunsen, who revered the floor where Lupin walked, explained why pure bloods were better and the half-breed should serve them or die.
"Isn't that right?" said Flitwick.
"Very well put, dear, very well put."
She made a small curtsy as she exited the room.
"He really got them tamed, eh, Snape?" said Goyle,
blessed idiot that he was, laughing boisterously. Unfortunately, this served to shake Bella awake from her stupor. Bellatrix, the sick sadist, who then asked about the Weasleys. Such a family of blood traitors, she would like to see what Severus had done with them.
"Weasleys get what Weasleys are,"
Amicus said, and there was something wild in his eyes. His sister laughed. Or something similar. And Parkinson's father couldn't help flinching.
It really was a grating laugh. If that insolent nurse hasn't taken them down, they should be hanging.
And then Amicus went on to tell them that the most obdurate students were experiencing long physical punishment, which involved being caged and flogged and hung from their wrists. He spared no detail and had Crab Sr. salivating over his description of how the girls cried and begged for mercy, how he had made the little Ginevra, the Weaselette, break at least six of her brother's bones before letting her out of the dungeon. This was a horrible thing to say, Severus knew. This, whatever this was a good charade, excellent, but they couldn't say this, it was too good. And now they would all want to see. Bellatrix, in particular, was breathing heavily, and said that she would like to see if she could make the little Longbottom more pliable. They wanted to give him her regards, oh, and news about his parents. Didn't they all think he would like to hear that?
No, said Electo, who until then had still been fidgeting with her bra, suddenly cold. She pushed her shoulders back, her spine straight.
You think you can come to my territory and play with my toys? Back off, bitch.
Electo Caro had looked at Bellatrix Lestrange straight in the eye, and she had called her a bitch.
Why, you little...
This was being a day full of surprises for Bella.
Tormento!
Electo didn't say a word. She barely flicked her wand, and Bellatrix's curse crashed against an invisible wall, spiraling upwards and disappearing with a hiss and a hint of smoke.
I ought to teach you some manners.
There was so much cruelty in the lines around Electo's mouth, so much fury and pain.
Ladies, please, Severus intervened, taking Electo's wrist so she would not curse Bellatrix, and deftly stepping between them. Nothing good could come of that. Bellatrix wasn't someone you would want to duel, no matter how good you were.
Let's not argue. We're all friends here, working for the same cause.
Severus spoke so carefully, his voice a mixture of iron and glass, clean and strong.
But I'm afraid I have to back Miss Caro here. They're her students, after all, and she should see how she punishes them. If she had decided they must be locked and withdrawn from all human contact, then so be it. I believe her methods have proved more than successful. Certainly better than Mr. Caro's in the long run.
There were some muttered arguments, although Bellatrix hissed, and Electo looked like she was seconds away from bashing her skull open with an old and seldom-used ashtray. Goyle Sr., who seemed like he was having a wonderful evening, spoke then and said not to ruin the party. They all had their people to torture, and Bella wouldn't like it if they were to take her prisoners, would she? She had been close to carving Avery Jr.'s eyes out with a knife because she still blamed him for Granger's escape. Everybody knew that, so she had to acquiesce. She couldn't go stealing people's prisoners after the big stink she had made. Crab looked disappointed. He had gotten excited about the idea of seeing them, already thinking that he could urinate on some of the bound prisoners. He didn't even think about them as students or children, just anonymous bodies to harm. Maybe make them crawl and beg, lick the side of his shoe, lick something else. Slughorn chose that moment to return accompanied by Crab and Goyle, Jr., who were holding a thrashing pansy Parkinson between them. The girl was full of cuts and bruises and disheveled.
"Father," said Gregory, "how wonderful to see you. Look what I've learned."
He dropped the arm he was holding, and with barely any hesitation, he turned around and cast the Cruciatus on Pansy. Her screams. Minerva flinched a little, and so did Flitwick. But other than that, nobody moved her eyes from her. Electo and Amicus walked to the back of the room, where they each took a gulp from a smoking cup, as if they couldn't be less interested in the spectacle. As if it were a common thing, routine. Pansy was still screaming and thrashing, held upright by Vincent Crab. When Goyle lifted his wand, at last she dropped, her legs too weak to keep her upright, and only the strength of Crab keeping her standing. The worst part, however, the worst part was when she got her breath back and said,
"Fuck you!"
to everyone.
"Fuck you all! And your ideas!"
And Scipio Parkinson took a step forward and cast Crucio on his own daughter. Not even a slap like Malfoy, not a word, as if she weren't human. This time she thrashed and writhed so much her robes pulled up, exposing a bit of a white tight and the flash of her underwear. Severus had to avert his eyes, his stomach roiling with nausea. Amicus and Crab Jr. and Sr. were smiling the worst smiles, something that made Severus want to hurl. Electo's lips, however, were pressed tight. In fact, all of her was a tight line of tension. Her lips and her shoulders and the arm with which she was holding the wand and even the line of her eyes following Pansy's movements. The wand.
Such insolence, Scipio murmured. I don't know where she got it. What kind of influences?
Draco, he meant.
How could she still be like that when Draco wasn't there to corrupt her? Convenient Draco, charming Draco, who gave an excuse for the children that refused to follow their parents' steps.
It wasn't them, and it wasn't their Death Eater parents. It was Draco and his pestilent influence. Certainly it was not Scipio Parkinson's fault. His loyalty had been proven beyond a doubt. Pansy was gasping and whining softly, her sweaty hair falling over her face.
Electo laughed her piggish laugh and told Crab and Goyle to take the girl and tie her outside.
A night in the yard would help her cool down. For a moment, Electo's eyes flashed blue. Severus accompanied the four Death Eaters to the gate of Hogwarts, feeling like a specter. He saw them cross the line and apparate away, and still he couldn't shake the feeling that his insides had been removed and he was currently filled with sawdust. After Gregory Goyle's performance, Vincent Crabbe had demonstrated his mastery of the Cruciatus, cursing a third-year Hufflepuff. The one who knew about Oompa Loompas, actually, who cried as if he were being gutted. And then Bella seemed to remember she was supposed to care about Bulstrode and ask after her. The girl came impeccably dressed with the school uniform and her hair neatly combed and meekly confessed not to be quite adept with curses yet, or anything that required physical exertion, but to be quite good at potions and cooking, as was proper for a young witch of her status. It was like seeing three, maybe three and a half, Narcissa Malfoys pressed together in a single body. Mrs. Babbling, the professor of ancient runes, had coughed softly and reminded Severus that bedtime was coming and perhaps they would like to stay and see the night reading. And so they had gone back to the great hall, where all the students were standing at attention by their house tables, although Severus saw a couple of Hufflepuffs wearing Gryffindor regalia, perhaps to even the numbers. Following the direction of the prefects, who were conjuring lines of text in the air, they all read in unison the joyous proclamation that had been printed in the Prophet about the new age that was coming and the importance of wizard pride. It was like something that Umbridge would have dreamt. The discipline, the obedience, the perfect order with which they exited the room. Slytherin first, as it was becoming, then Ravenclaw. Gryffindor last, of course, girls and boys keeping 2 feet of separation between them. Goyle had slapped Bellatrix on the back amicably.
"I'm sure some of them had to be imperious," he said. "Can't be all that good, eh?"
And she had accepted it. She had accepted it because here were most of the students dutifully reciting the official words and making vows and studying hard to come to join the lines of Voldemort's ranks. She had accepted it because as much as she despised Snape, this was something she wanted to see and believe. A world in which people loved Voldemort as much as her, yes. Soon after, they had all left. Severus walked slowly back to the doors of the castle. The night air was cool, and it felt good against his pulsing temples. Electo was waiting by the door, shifting from foot to foot. Her robe seemed to have shrunk recently, and it exposed her ankles. Her brown hair had also acquired a reddish hue.
"Everyone gone, Headmaster? Are we good?"
Were they? Honestly, Severus had no idea. He had a tension headache is what he had.
"I believe so," he said, because true, the Death Eaters had come and they had left Hogwarts, and even Bella had been convinced once she saw a Gryffindor walk past carrying the books of a Slytherin student. Or maybe she still suspected, but in any case, they were gone. Severus had seen them leave, and he had closed the gates after them. They could not come back.
"Great,"
Electo said, her voice coming a bit more deeply. She stood in front of Severus with her right hand up, palm open. She grinned,
Her cheeks had freckles. "Come on, don't leave a man hanging here," she said, for a meaning of the word she. She shook the hand in the air a little bit. Severus sighed heavily, but he high-fived her. It had been earned. "May I ask why you didn't take the form of Amicus?" Not that Severus cared much, but it seemed like the logical choice. "I'm the only one who can make the laugh well enough," said still Electo, because that was still Electo's face, but definitely Ron's voice. He demonstrated. Everybody was exhausted and a bit dizzy from the adrenaline still rushing through their systems. Severus stared at the refugees coming out of one of the secret tunnels where they had been hiding and was honestly shocked at the amount of people emerging one by one, all pale with fear but smiling. Surely he hadn't brought that many. And what the hell had happened? "As soon as we received your message, we began preparations," Sprout told him. She was smiling too, and Severus noticed she had a truly nice smile. Next to her, Professor Babbling was also grinning and leaning a bit on her for support. It had been truly nerve-wracking. "What message?" asked Severus. "Your message? With the Patronus?" "Oh dear." "I did not send a message. I was surrounded by Death Eaters at the time." There were 5 seconds of silence. Even Sirius managed to be quiet.
"You must have been surprised by our little charade, then," says Lockhorn at last.
"Very much." "Good."
And for the mercy of Morgana, but Minerva was a vindictive woman. Also, her voice sounded terribly deep, as if it were coming from the lowest boilers from hell.
"You deserve it, for what you put us through at the beginning of the semester."
Did he really? He had derived some small enjoyment from it, certainly, but it had been necessary. He needed to get the password from the Karo's minds. He had made a very humorous reference to compensate. No, frankly, Severus didn't think he deserved any of the stress he was suffering. Another thing he didn't deserve, the wonderful boyfriend he had somehow gotten, who was now dropping a big comforting hand on his shoulder, his thumb squeezing on one of the knots of tension Severus had gotten. The Patronus had already vanished, but somehow its words remained, uttered softly like the feathers of the animal that carried the message.
"Snape coming, accompanied by Bellatrix, Parkinson, Crab, and Goyle. Expect Hogwarts to be perfect prison."
For the next few seconds, nobody spoke. They didn't breathe. And there was something very much like terror grasping at their temples and squeezing, taking their vision and their hearing. Isildur Glass had thick, ugly glasses and a complex over her weight, although she was not as fat as she believed. She also had multiple friends who couldn't return to Hogwarts this year, and friends who only did because they had been rescued, and she would do anything to protect them. She pointed her wand at the walls and started to take their unorthodox decorations, making space to put back the usual paraphernalia of the four houses. Hufflepuffs tends to be humble and unassuming, and they are the last people one would think about when preparing for battle. Gryffindors are the obvious choice, followed by either Ravenclaws or Slytherins, because anyone carrying a smart, cunning plan is welcome to participate in a fight. But Hufflepuffs have that kind of resilience that easily becomes hopefulness. When a Hufflepuff speaks and says something will be done, it is easy to imagine it being done, to see the achievement accomplished. When a Hufflepuff speaks, it is easy to take their drive and let it carry you to the goal. They didn't know how much time they had. Probably an hour if Snape made the sensible choice of apparating into Hogsmeade and walking from there. An hour to put everything back as it was, an hour to bring back the four houses' decorations, dot the unused sand watches with the points, and make sure that somehow all the Slytherin paraphernalia was shinier and in a higher position than the rest. Definitely take down the shrine to Draco on the posters calling for union against evil. Definitely take down the twins' version of the Mors Mordra. It could be done. Working diligently and together, it could be done. There was an emergency meeting between faculty, prefects, and some of the adult refugees to hatch some sort of plan together. To everyone's bewilderment, the best strategist turned out not to be a Slytherin. The next Slytherin in line, Professor Slughorn,
had always been more concerned with eating chocolates and accumulating connections with powerful people. Sadly, there had been a tragic lack on both accounts in recent years. The most he did for the crisis was pointing out that no matter how well they played their roles, it would be nothing if they couldn't present the Caros.
"So we choose two people, not teachers, to pull you like them," said Philip. Philip was the other resident werewolf in Hogsmeade, and an absolute sweetheart. He was still healing from his wounds because werewolves were supposed to be dark creatures, and therefore those who refused the call of the Dark Lord were punished severely. Killed was more like it.
"The potion takes a month to brew." This was said in almost unison by Professor Slughorn and every Ravenclaw present.
"Horace," said Professor Sinistra, fellow Slytherin, "are you telling me that you don't have some prepared already, really?"
"I may have some in my office," he admitted, "although I can't vouch for the quality or the length of duration."
"I believe Severus has some too," added Remus, "because he will be surprised if he didn't." "It's in a glass container on the cabinets by the window," Luna said with her dreamy voice and her dreamy eyes. "He showed me. For emergencies, he said."
He had not. What he had done was point at the cabinet and tell her to stay well away from it because it was very dangerous. "I mean it, Lovegood. If you somehow survive the gruesome accident that will befall you if you touch them, I will kill you myself for disobeying. Yes, you may have a piece of licorice." That was only a partial solution. There was much more to do. They had to choose the best candidates to impersonate the Caros. They had to prepare a little show for their visitors' benefit. Ravenclaws were the answer, just put them to memorize the Prophet's propaganda. And they had to decide what to do with the Death Eater's children, because surely they would ask after them. They had to hide all the people that shouldn't be there and have an evacuation plan ready if things went sour. All this was not thought and resolved by a Slytherin. Sure, the Slytherins were good at spotting loopholes, and they were the ones to figure out how to pretend to be tortured. The Cruciatus only works if you intend it, and Gregory Goyle did not want to hurt Pansy. Her father did, but Ron's Protegos took the worst of it. But in this case, it wasn't just about finding an ingenious way out of a tight situation. It was about keeping the big picture in your mind, and knowing the exact position of multiple players, and predicting your enemy's movements and counteracting them. It was about carefully maneuvering to force your opponent down a certain path. It was very much like chess, and both Ron Weasley and Minerva McGonagall were very good at it. The refugees were too numerous to successfully hide them in an empty room, but they could be put in a single line in one of the tunnels that Ron knew about, even if he swore he never made use of them. The twins were put at the head, and if things went truly bad, they would be ready to start hacking down at the wards. Weaker there, away from Hogwarts, and ignored by the Caros. They only had to make an aperture big enough for one person to slide through. Sirius and Remus would stay on the other side, protecting the entrance to the tunnel until everyone was out. Sirius had made a big fuss about it because he wanted to play Amicus Caro and everyone said no.
"Honestly, all my life hearing that blacks are too melodramatic, and now you won't let me be an actor. I've never in my life felt more insulted. This is a disgrace."
The twins also wanted to play the Caros, and their argument that they were already very well attuned to each other carried certain weight. However, they were more needed down the tunnel, and as it turned out, Ron was really good at mimicking Electo's laughter. There was no good reason why Ginny should be the one to play Amicus, other than that she had asked, and it was too much effort to say no. She didn't take no for an answer, but she had no problem saying no to others, and Minerva was quite glad that she had made her prefect. There were many things that could have gone wrong. Ginny could have failed to make up anything when they asked about Amicus's methods. Millicent could have not gotten herself dressed in time. Pansy might have kept screaming long after Gregory Goyle lifted his wand, thus proving that it was all a charade. Many things could have gone wrong, but they didn't. Should they blame Draco for it? For his call for interhouse work? Or maybe it was Harry? Sweet, strange Harry who gave Draco that book, and who always, invariably, called everyone by their first name, as if he cared about them as people. Things could have gone wrong, but Ginny was coached by Theodore Knott and Marietta Edgecombe on what to say. Millicent got an extreme makeover in less than 10 minutes, with over 7 witches and wizards working on her. Vincent Crabbe, who had a resting troll face, practiced with Pansy to squeeze her arms when Gregory lifted his wand so that their little play would go seamlessly. They made it. They made it. It didn't look like a battle, but it was, and they had won.
"I thought it strange somehow," Remus said as he poured Severus a glass of water and dropped a soft kiss on his temple. Severus was so tired he couldn't even drag himself to bed. He was so tired he doubted he could sleep. His stomach had only just started to settle, and he still had a tension headache. Didn't look like your Patronus at all. Even though I've never seen it, I don't know what shape it is, but a swan, no. To be frank, Severus didn't know what shape it would be at the moment. Certainly not a swan, no, but probably not a doe either. He didn't dare cast it for fear of what would come. He wasn't sure if he was afraid that it would be a wolf or that it wouldn't be. Maybe it would still be a doe, not for the friend he lost, but for the child he reluctantly called his. "Didn't anyone notice it wasn't my voice?" "Too soft," answered Remus, coming to the sofa. "Scoot." Severus did, lazily, and Remus sat next to him, sides pressed together. Already he could feel the iron rod that was his neck beginning to relax. "We weren't sure to begin with. It had to be you or Galahad." "Please don't tell me anything about Galahad. I already have too many secrets tumbling through my mind." "Not a word," Remus promised, laughing. Both he and Sirius had kept their vow of silence on Galahad, even though there was quite a lot of interest. At least one-third of the refugees in Hogwarts knew they had arrived there thanks to him, thanks to the little notes that burned as soon as they were read, and that directed them to a place where Severus could find them. The other two-thirds weren't sure, but were starting to think they might have been secretly directed by him. Remus and Sirius were the only ones who had seen him face to face, though, so of course they were being asked about it. Was he tall and dreamy? Did he have a long beard? Was he perhaps wearing a green raincoat? Severus refused to learn a single detail about it because he had seen some spark of humor in Remus's eyes that told him there was something hugely amusing about Galahad's identity. And he vaguely remembered Harry chattering about medieval knights, both real and fictional. So there was something there, and he really, really, really didn't want to figure it out. But in any case, Remus was kissing him now softly, the scratch of his beard leaving something like little stars on Severus's skin. And at long last, on this horrible and stupid day, he was allowed to relax. Percy's Patronus used to be a particularly ruffled representation of an owl, and the twins had laughed themselves sick when they saw it. Percy had been immensely proud of being able to cast one when he was 14, and perhaps he had bragged a little bit around the burrow, but after their laughs, he stopped casting it completely out of DADA class, and they seldom ever practiced it in that class. However, at some point in the last few years, his Patronus had changed. He knew because sometimes he had to go down to the Wizengamot, and there were Dementors there. It was a shark. A classic-looking shark, not one of those weird ones with the hammerhead. Not too big, either. People thought that it was very fitting, because Percy had a reputation now. The ruthless clerk. The one Gryffindor, they said, brave enough to see that the new order was better. Percy liked this new form. A shark is a perfectly nice fish with a bad reputation, after all, so it felt incredibly fitting, more than people would ever know. Plus, he liked seeing it swim across the air in a graceful dance. He liked seeing that there was some part of him that could be this beautiful, this elegant. Until he took up yoga, Percy had never felt at ease in his body. He grew much too fast, and he hadn't gotten the hang of his new height. Now he felt more comfortable in his body, which was not a small blessing, considering how often he felt like he was somewhere else.
"We're still missing one," Draco said, frowning. He had a spectacular frown. It was hilarious. He and Hermione didn't take it well when they couldn't understand something immediately. Harry, on the other hand, understood very little and was okay with it, because he suspected that what most people understood was wrong anyway. "One in Hogwarts, one with another Death Eater," Harry said, counting with his fingers. It felt like he had done this same gesture 100 times already. "One that we have no idea if it exists at all."
"Logic would say Ravenclaw, Hufflepuff, and Gryffindor."
Hermione was sitting cross-legged, dressed, but with her hair in a state. It was one of those easy days when they woke up, had breakfast, and migrated to the library, and at around 11, someone realized they had washed and put on a nice top, but were still wearing pajama bottoms, or were missing a sock, or didn't put the toothbrush away and had been using it as a pointer all this time. Nice lazy days that made it look as if planning the fight against an absolutist monster was something normal and easy. Days in which Hermione's scar was less angry, less pink. She turned her head a bit.
"I don't think he used a Gryffindor relic.
On the other hand, it would be a way of appropriating something valued by the enemy and desecrating its symbolic worth." You know, I don't think Voldemort gave it that much thought, Draco. Harry propped his chin on Draco's shoulder. Draco had had the indecency of growing a lot during the last year, but finally Harry had gotten his own growth spurt and caught up with him.
What about the Death Eater idea?
Hermione said while she looked at the tea mug by her side. She didn't remember getting it, but it was still a bit hot.
Who else would he trust with the Horcrux?
Someone very loyal, like crazy loyal. Harry pushed a bit of his hair away, only for it to fall back to his face immediately.
Someone with a big house, I think. You know, with an estate and all that entails, so they would have plenty of space to hide it.
Probably one of the Sacred 28, then, Draco said. Although the key here is whether he preferred... What was that?
Kind of sounded like a boiler breaking,
said Hermione, putting the mysterious mug back on the table. There had been a big hollow sound, something that was more echo than anything else.
Please, 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 let's still have warm water, prayed Harry, who had his priorities very clear.
The sound was heard again, and this time the whole house shook. This was not a thing the house usually did.
What? I don't... Oh, creature. Creature is here. Creature, is something broken?
Yes, master. The wards, master. Creature is holding them, but they are pushing.
The elf hadn't sounded so distraught in weeks, maybe months. What day was today? Never mind, the house shook again and the glasses rattled. They went to the lobby, where the portrait of Walburga was already screaming, although muffled by all the blankets on top of it. Hermione arrived first, and she stood on tiptoe to look through some of the empty spaces in the lace curtains.
Oh, shit! There are Death Eaters out there!
She called. Half a dozen Death Eaters, yes, standing at the door of their house.
What? This isn't good.
No, it was not. Six wizards, six dark wizards, not even bothering with the masks they used to wear. They looked so tall and strong, even though in reality they were not that taller than them. But enemies always look bigger, and they had their wands pointed at the door. One of them saw them looking through the window and cast something red and sharp that made the glass fill with cracks, although it didn't break. They jumped back. The papers, said Draco, because honestly, Draco was excellent in a crisis. He was horrible day to day because he would stop you on the stairs or give you a 20-minute lecture over how you were a despicable human being that didn't rinse his or her toothbrush properly, and so allowed for the formation of white rings on the bottom of the cup. White rings of soap scum being a portal to hell, apparently. He had claimed his own glass and his own fork and his own armchair and three pillows and fought like a diva whenever anyone tried to use them or, even worse, handed him the wrong one. But in a crisis, Draco could keep his head ice cold.
We have to take or destroy all the research we have on Horcruxy. Don't let them find out that we know. No, I think what we need to do is make sure they don't get inside the house, called Harry.
The house shook again. The wood of the door splintered and grew some thin cracks, almost as if it were sick.
You take the papers, said Hermione.
She was breathing fast, and she looked scared. She didn't look scared when they fought other Death Eaters in their research escapades, but then again, this time they were coming to their house, and they had taken them by surprise. Harry squeezed her shoulder and didn't remove his hand right away. He let her notice his presence and let it ground her.
And get your bandolier, Draco, she added.
It made sense. Both Harry and her had their wands in their hands already. They should stay at the door.
Maybe think of an escape route. Protego Maxim.
The door stopped growing cracks, but the wood was now dark and fragile like the one from a shipwreck. Harry put his hand on it and took it away quickly. It felt gross, wet and moldy. He planted his feet firmly and bent his knees slightly to make himself more stable. He knew he could do something about it. Breathe slowly once, twice, and start imagining a stone wall, maybe, or a very, very long corridor squeezed in the space of the threshold so that it would take them days to cross it. In the background, he could hear Draco moving, murmuring something. There were the loud screams of the wizards outside casting curses, although he could also hear what seemed like female voices, so he didn't know why he kept thinking of wizards, and in any case, he should concentrate. To his left, Hermione was casting and casting one protective spell after another, and even though she was standing right there, her voice came softer than the ones outside. Calmer, too, now. Less passion, less emotion. She cast with the firmness of a professional, as if this were another job or a practical exercise, as if she were doing it for a grade rather than to save lives. His hand was still on her right shoulder. She didn't shake it away, and Harry really didn't want to lose the connection. He could feel himself sweating cold. He wasn't sure what happened next. Maybe there was a moment of stillness, a moment when the Death Eaters outside lowered their wands in respect and grew silent. Maybe there was a loud pop or a whoosh, and for a second a shadow covered the windows outside. What there was, and Harry knew very well, was a sudden explosion that pushed through the magical barriers, completely disintegrated the door, and sent Hermione and him flying to the end of the corridor. The fall hurt. His left elbow was hurting like crazy, and there were wooden splinters sticking out of his skin. While Berger was screaming high enough to hear, despite the blankets, and there was a tall, tall, tall figure standing on the threshold that Harry barely had time to protect. The backlight obscured his face, but Harry knew that silhouette well. The bald head and the shoulders, strong shoulders, but with a sharp quality, as if the man were made of blades, and the height, of course. How could Harry forget that looming height? Harry had been pretty short when he was 14, a month and a half shy of 15. He had been even smaller when he was 1 year old. Voldemort stood in the entrance of his house. Not his home, this wasn't home, but a safe place that they had claimed, and that was theirs. He was here, crossing the door, coming in. Given what they knew of Voldemort, the man who made his followers wear matching robes, masks, and tattoos, they were all expecting a bit more after such a dramatic entrance. Not that this was the time to discuss their disappointment, but it still felt like they had been robbed of a Harry Potter, we meet at last, or a your time is up, or even it's time to finish what I started. Although truly, he seemed to be more the kind to say, time to sever our binding, Harry Potter, only I will prevail. But he didn't say any of that. They couldn't know, of course. They hadn't even thought about it, because they were more concerned with Harry. But Voldemort had been scared, truly scared, when Harry got up that night in the graveyard. Because he was a kid, a useless wizard by all accounts, that nevertheless had managed to master that which Voldemort desired most. So he would lose no time exchanging pleasantries or threats. He came, he saw, he raised his wand, and pointed it straight at Harry's chest. And for once in his life, Harry lifted his wand, too, because Hermione was on the ground beside him, and Draco was in the library next door, so Harry wasn't about to waste any time scrambling to his feet or putting his glasses back. It was a big figure standing in a narrow corridor. There was no way he could miss, and he could cast from the floor.
Avada Kedavra!
Expelliarmus! Sometimes Draco wanted to smother Harry, but he supposed he wouldn't be Harry if he didn't avoid killing or seriously hurting even the most truly abhorrent beings in existence. Not that turning people into trees and leaving them there wasn't badass and terrible, but there was also something very non-violent about it, like they could transform back after a while, or at the very least serve as a home for woodland creatures. At least it wasn't Wingardium Leviosa, so Draco couldn't complain. Now that he was standing, and Hermione had shoved his glasses back onto his face, Harry could see a bit more of Voldemort and his utterly crushed expression, a mix of defeat, rage, and high-quality surprise. Maybe a bit of fear, too. He didn't know why he was acting so surprised. This seemed pretty normal to Harry. They had fired at exactly the same time, so now the spells were locked, green versus red, and funny thing, each person's eyes were the color of the other's spell. Maybe he should tell him. Harry thought it was a truly fun coincidence. But the locking of the spells thing, oh, Harry knew about that. It was like the Mach Force duels he played with Olivia, like every kind of sword or magic duel ever portrayed on television. Both contenders locked, and it was only the strength of the hero that would manage to get him the upper hand. Harry was already more than halfway done. Voldemort had been too surprised to fight him back. And the best thing, the very best thing in this horrible disaster, was that the entrance corridor was narrow, and Voldemort had barely stepped out of the door before casting, so now his followers couldn't get in. Not when they had to squeeze behind their beloved and feared Dark Lord, and when Hermione was already upright and firing back. The snake, though, the huge snake that slid between Voldemort's feet and slithered towards them, that was a problem. Draco stuck out his head from the library, saw Harry and Voldemort with their wands locked and Hermione fighting a huge snake and the few Death Eaters who dared show their faces from behind Voldemort's back. Draco's face said something like, "How is this my life?" Truly, Hermione could understand the feeling. but at least he promptly took his hands to the bandolier to help Hermione fight the snake, which she appreciated because that snake was like something out of a movie. No matter what she did, the snake kept jumping back to her, and what kind of animal wasn't afraid of fire? Its mouth had been a pair of fangs, long and sharp, and Hermione remembered how sick Mr. Weasley had become, how the poison kept opening the wound back.
"Room's clean," murmured Draco, who had set fire to most papers. She could smell the smoke. "We should go," Hermione whispered back as she made a whip-like movement with her wrist, and she sent the damned snake blasting back. They really should go, even if they managed to push Voldemort back, and she still couldn't believe her own two eyes and the locked spells. Their location had been revealed. In the best of cases, they would be trapped in there under siege, and that was assuming they could erect all the wards back. No, they had to move. She wished she could sneak upstairs just for a minute to get their things, but she had her wand in her hand, and so did Harry and Draco, so to speak, and they had taken down the incriminating information. So now it was down to figuring out how to get away from there. "I can't fly," she said, just in case, because she really, really, really didn't trust herself on a broom. "No time," Draco shot back. He did some twisty motion, and something beautiful and onyx black came spiraling out of his hands and glided down the corridor to land on the face of the intrepid witch that was peering out to the right of Voldemort. Harry's stream of light was more than 3/4 done. Funny thing, Hermione noticed, and she thought that no one had ever mentioned this in the very few descriptions she had read of the phenomenon. But anyway, she noticed that the stream on Voldemort's side hadn't been shortened exactly. The killing curse was coiling like a spring, or like that bloody snake that still, even now, was trying to bite them. She had seen those muggles in Little Whinging, and she hated using that word. They weren't muggles, they were a bunch of boys. Hit a curse and sent it back. She now wondered if the Avada Kedavra would shoot back with extra force after being pressed like that. But in any case, Harry's red stream was almost touching the end of Voldemort's wand, so white and long like the bone of an abyssal fish. Draco was saying something about getting their escape route ready. Could she manage alone for a minute? And the red touched the white wand. Harry wasn't sure what would happen when either of the spells reached the other end. He had been hoping for an explosion. Explosions seemed fitting, and it would be really convenient if Voldemort were to lose his wand and hand, maybe, in a small blast. But no, the stream of light changed slowly from red to a gold so pale it was almost white. Voldemort's wand let out some ripples of golden dust that contained the echoes of something bigger, and after that came soft whispers followed by screams. And they were not loud screams. It was more as if they were coming from very far away, but still clearly identifiable as screams of terror and pain. Then there were more whispers, and then the first golden figure dropped from the wand. Not an explosion, no. Harry certainly hadn't been expecting that.
"I am dead,"
the figure said sadly. A man with frizzy hair. Voldemort's wand was doing more things, but certainly nothing as impressive as dropping an actual golden ghost in their foyer.
"Oh dear,"
murmured a woman, middle-aged, looked a bit familiar, as soon as she came from the wand. Many screams followed after her appearance.
"Your encounter too," whispered Hermione. "The echoes of the previous spells a wand has cast."
That was an explanation, but it wasn't useful in the least, because Harry had no idea of what to do other than hold fast. It occurred to him that as long as he kept the connection, Voldemort couldn't use his wand for anything else, and that was a very good thing. Voldemort, for his part, did not look very happy to see the ghosts of his victims. The first two were a bit confused, granted, and there was this man who dropped to his knees as soon as he came from the wand and wailed and wailed. He was too thin, and he had very long hair and a funny scar like a half-moon under his left eye. They could hear him sobbing and begging for his life. But other than the sobbing man, for the most part, and there really was a truly awful amount of people emerging from the wand, the ghosts had quite a lot to say to Voldemort, and it wasn't very nice. They were dead, you see. They were dead, and they didn't have anything to be afraid of anymore. But they had quite a lot for to be angry.
"Where do you think you're going, scum?"
The ghost, a woman with a big perky bottom and big fatty arms, turned to the redhead Death Eater. Harry's heart skipped a beat at the sight of the hare that was slowly trying to make his way inside the house. The woman extended her arm, hand open, and oh, how Harry wished Olivia and Dean Thomas could see this, because it was just like a Jedi using the Force. and the Death Eater was pushed back to the front garden. There were more screams and more whispers and more indignation, and Harry could sort of hear Hermione and Draco moving around him, but he really couldn't spare them any attention. He had to trust that they knew what they were doing, just as he trusted that they would deal with the snake, awful snake. It could still move towards them, even though the ghosts had been able to stop everyone else from taking a single step. And the snake was mean, not like any other snake Harry had had the pleasure to meet. Her single-mindedness was remarkable. But Harry certainly couldn't stop and chat with her and see what the matter was that made her so angry. All he could do was focus to keep pushing the light stream out, away from him and towards Voldemort. It was hard, and he was sweating, and his right arm, from his hands to his shoulder and even part of his back, was tight with tension and aching. But it was also becoming a bit easier the longer he did this. He still had to use a lot of energy, but he felt that now he could look around a little bit, see the ghosts. Well, over 24 now, how dreadful that was, standing there making a barrier. He could spare a few seconds to think that the specter of a white hand he saw coming from Voldemort's wand was maybe the spell to give Pettigrew his silver hand, and that meant the wand would not have seen much use for those 13 years, right? So the next echoes. Even though she had her back to him, even though Harry had last seen her when he was 15 months old, or when he was 14 in a death dream, he knew instantly that that was his mother. Lily Evans was coming from the wand. It was probably wishful thinking that Harry thought that she shone brighter than any other spirit. Lily had the strong back of a swimmer, and she didn't turn around to look at her son. Her feet, her ghost feet, barely touched the floor before she extended her arm, her hand coming to Voldemort's face. He screamed. It couldn't be pain, because this was a ghost. Less than a ghost, actually, even if they were golden. They were just the soft echoes of a curse. It couldn't be pain, so it must have been fear. Even the snake stopped in its tracks, and if that were possible at all, flattened against the floor. The next ghost was Harry's father, and wow, yes, that was definitely Harry's face. He got it now. It was so strange seeing him and seeing his mother, too. Those two persons he loved, even though he hadn't really met them. It was so strange to see that man who was his father but not his dad. Harry looked at him, and the light thread of the spell wavered. He wanted to talk to them, to ask, although he didn't know what to say.
Harry, listen to me.
James had come to him the moment he was out, almost as if they had a previous agreement, Lily and him.
You have to stay with the living.
Yes, I...
You can't live with the dead,
said James Potter, his father, stressing every syllable.
Forget about us. Focus on living and being happy, all right? You have to be happy. Tell Remus and that git well done for me.
Harry swallowed. His throat was dry, and he felt as if there were needles stuck there and in the corner of his eyes.
And if you want to open an ice cream parlor... That's fine,
he said, which was a bit of an odd thing to say to the son you didn't get to raise. His eyes were focused on Harry as he spoke, dark and firm. He had very dark eyes, James Potter. Then he suddenly moved those eyes to the left.
Is that a Malfoy?
Not only did Harry look very much like his father, but he was also very much like James in certain regards. The petting animals thing, for example. Or that tendency to jump 3 or 4 steps when explaining ideas. This was a good thing, because there wasn't much time, and James, or, well, his ghost, his spirit, the echo of him, looked around and made a leap of thought, and he understood. There wasn't much time, but he would get to say his piece.
Anyway.
His voice was slightly lighter now, less weighted with emotion.
Ice cream. You can do that if you want. You don't have to be an Aura, or a Quidditch player, or Minister for Magic, understand? And the Malfoy, yes. You have to teach him how to cast a Patronus, Harry. These kids from pure-blood families, they don't know how. Teach him that. Take care of each other.
Harry couldn't know this, but Sirius had mused once, after he saw Harry and Draco bumping into each other and smiling while playing football with the gnomes. Sirius had seen them and had thought that if James had been there, he would have found it all hilarious. James Potter... If confronted with his son bringing home Draco L. Malfoy, be it as an adopted brother or as something else, would have laughed and laughed and probably sent a howler to Lucius laughing some more. No words, just his laughter.
Harry didn't know this, but he knew what his father meant. James had looked at him, and he had seen. In a second, he had understood more than anyone else in the room, and Harry, he understood too what he meant about the ice cream. His hand was shaking. He didn't think he could hold this much longer.
"We love you very much, both of us."
The next breath that Harry took felt as if he had buried his face in a bag full of needles and pins. His eyes and his mouth and his throat prickled with held tears.
"That isn't much time, Harry."
James licked his lips.
"Give a hug to Sirius for me, will you? A tight one, so he understands."
Harry nodded. He couldn't speak, not right now.
"Girl, your air is excellent."
James pointed at Hermione before stepping back to the entrance. The place was full of ghosts now. More people had come after his parents, but really, how could Harry notice?
"Ashley, we can hold him for a few minutes, don't you all think?"
said an old man with no teeth, holding a cane as if he very well were about to clock someone on the head with it.
"Ready?"
Someone was taking his left hand, a cold hand, small, soft. And that was Hermione then. And the hands on his shoulders must be Draco's, and the three of them were nodding to James. Lily was still at the head, putting the fear of herself in Voldemort.
"Now!"
Harry lowered his wand. His mother turned around, and he saw her, just like in that half-remembered dream that wasn't a dream at all, that time with the smell of apricots. She mouthed the words, "I love you." And then he could see her no more. The ghosts were all falling in between, making a barrier, and Draco and Hermione were pushing him, which was probably a very good idea because Harry felt rooted to the spot and his feet were too heavy. They came to the library. The walls were shaking, or maybe Harry was shaking so much that he thought the walls were doing it, and there was a very high-pitched screech, like glass breaking, and maybe that was Voldemort, or the ghosts pushing against him, or Walburga Black, or all of them together. Draco dropped to his knees and took Creature by the shoulders. There was dried blood on the elf's nose, and his ears and his lips were almost purple, contrasting starkly with his pale skin.
"Creature, listen to me. These are my orders. You have to save yourself. You can't let anyone harm you, all right? Go to Hogwarts. There was another elf there, Dobby. He can help you."
"Tell him I sent you," Harry said. The house was definitely shaking, and he may have missed something important, but he agreed with the current assumption that the house wouldn't hold upright much longer, and it was better to send Creature somewhere safe. And there was a green fire and funny thing, but that was not something that Harry liked. Green light and green fire, and maybe he was mixing Maleficent with Voldemort, but they were both super scary, and he just didn't like that shade of green at all. Hermione tried to push him in, but Harry didn't move.
"Harry, come on!"
No, you first. This was not cowardice, though. He may not like that horrible tone of green, but he wasn't completely out of it. He knew it was the fireplace, and it was flue powder, which was precisely why he was sending Hermione first, and Draco next. He would go last. Draco threw another handful of powder and pushed Hermione unceremoniously.
"Ladies first, Granger. Muggle-born ladies first."
And since she was already there, she didn't argue. She simply said the words, "Licky cauldron." In the same tone, one said, "There will be consequences," and she disappeared. Harry turns to give Draco a half-smile of thanks, but the bastard, the utter bastard, oh, the prat Slytherin he had to be, that complete and utter arsehead, went and pushed Harry next.
"Leaky cauldron," Harry said.
Although the intonation meant something along the lines of, "The moment we step out and run out of the place and get to a safe distance, I am going to, I don't know what I will do, but it will be unpleasant, you git, how dare you?" Draco was the only one related by blood to the house. It was only proper that he would be the last one to abandon it, and it was not a moment too soon. The ghosts vanished soon after, and whatever happened next, whether it was the pent-up energy on Voldemort's wand, or the rage at their escape, or the fear he was still experiencing, it didn't matter. The ground floor blew up. Walls, doors, windows, everything exploded. And they shouldn't have worried about hiding their research after all, because everything shattered into little more than dust. The largest pieces of debris were no bigger than a child's hand. And since the upper floors were using the ground floor for support, the whole house toppled down. The attic with its portraits of sleeping people and chest full of cursed relics, the polished dark wood floors that gave Hermione flashbacks, the cursed bathrooms and the bedrooms in which both Regulus and Sirius Black had been so unhappy, all came down, crashing and shattering. In the end, all that remained from the ancestral seat of the House of Black was a pile of rubble and a cloud of dust over it. End of chapter 12.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.